It's her most high-profile and controversial call to date as State Attorney Melissa Nelson decides not to charge a police officer in the shooting of a Jacksonville man, Vernell Bing Jr. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to get our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, we speak with Florida Times Union reporter Ben Konark, who's been following the 16-month investigation into the shooting death of Vernell Bing Jr. and has the latest on the state attorney's decision. What do you think about this? Give us a call. 549-2937. Then later, how World Relief is doing much more these days than helping to resettle refugees. They're also coming to the aid of hurricane victims. Find out how they might be even helping you at your house. Plus, some information on how you can be a big brother or sister to some of the most vulnerable kids here on the First Coast. All of that ahead. But first this hour, State Attorney Melissa Nelson is out this week with a closely watched decision on a controversial police-involved shooting from last year. After a 16-month criminal investigation, Nelson says no charges will be filed in the 2016 shooting incident that killed Jacksonville resident Vernell Bing Jr. Bing's death sparked protests and a lawsuit. But Nelson's office says Bing's shooting was justified under Florida law and that they believe JSO officer Tyler Landerville's account of why he opened fire on Bing. There is lots to discuss here. Reporter Ben Konark of the Florida Times Union has been following the story all along, and he's on the line now with some insights. Ben, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. As protests have erupted in cities around the country when police officers are either not charged or not convicted in the shooting deaths of unarmed black men, we want your thoughts on this decision here in Jacksonville in the case of the death of Vernell Bing Jr. Give us a call with your questions, with your comments. The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. You can also weigh in on our Facebook page. So Ben Konark, State Attorney Nelson proactively released a lot of information, many documents to provide to media and interested observers to sort of provide explanation for this decision. Let's begin with that. Lots of information that she wants the public to know about related to this case. As you looked through it, what were the most important pieces of information that stuck out to you?
Oh, well, we haven't quite gotten through all of it yet. But, you know, I think if you're looking for the most comprehensive look at the investigation, there's an executive report there that goes through not only the Bing case, but also some of the considerations the office had when deciding whether or not the shooting was justified based on Florida law.
And how does Florida law, under Nelson's interpretation of it, justify her declining to file charges against the officer?
Well, it's it is a high legal standard to convict an officer, of any charge, really. You have to prove quite a few things, and I think basically what it boiled down to was, you know, the prosecutors found credible Tyler Landerville's explanation of why he fired, basically that he was in fear for his life, that he felt that Vernell Bing was tracking him with his eyes and moving away in a manner that made him feel like he was not fleeing, but instead, reaching for something in his waistband.
And let's go back to the actual incident. It happened in 2016 in Springfield. The police officer Landerville and Bing met. They literally collided when Bing's red Camaro, which it turned out had been stolen, accelerated and hit the officer's cruiser head on. Before that collision, as you report in the Times Union, Landerville had heard over the radio that the suspect was considered to be armed and dangerous. Then the paths diverge, correct? There are differing accounts as to what happened next. Both men emerged from their cars. The police officer, Landerville, said he thought he saw Bing reach in the direction of his waistband. Eyewitnesses on the street in Springfield say they saw Bing limping away from his vehicle. Can you give me a little bit more information, Ben, about the differing eyewitness accounts and why? And that seems to have been what sparked the controversy more than anything, what people say happened. And there's no video, I don't believe, for people to refer to. But what about these different eyewitness accounts?
Well, there's some surveillance footage, but I don't believe it shows the final moments. And I should, you know, with the caveat that I have, like I said, I have not gone through every document yet. But, you know, basically that there's a wider issue here in the criminal justice system as far as eyewitness accounts. And this is one situation where it's kind of, you know, working in law enforcement's favor. You know, I've studied wrongful convictions, and there are a lot of concerns with wrongful convictions that they usually stem from cases that were kind of hinging on an eyewitness account. You know, memory is a funny thing, and we can be 100% sure we saw one thing when, in fact, we saw something quite different. So these eyewitness accounts are kind of all we had in the wake of this shooting. You know, we didn't have any explanation from the sheriff's office, which is actually unusual for this sheriff's office. Jacksonville Sheriff's Office is more vocal in the wake of police shootings than most police departments. They're usually giving two press conferences. If the shooting occurs at an evening, they'll usually give one that night, and then they'll have maybe a larger, more organized press conference the next day. And that in itself is not, you know, not how a lot of police departments operate. So with this one, I think a lot of people in the newsroom were curious about it because they said a lot less about the shooting than most shootings. So we were kind of always wondering what the explanation would be as for why you know, Officer Landerville opened fire. So now we have that explanation for the first time. So it was kind of, for me, I think the most revealing part of that evening was looking at Officer Landerville's statement, because, you know, he made that, I would think, within a few days of the shooting, and we just saw it for the first time, and you can kind of, for the first time, see the shooting through his eyes.
And so the officer saying he thought Bing was reaching for a weapon, correct?
Right, yeah. So it's reaching for his waistband, right? So there's a term that gets thrown around a lot now in police shootings. And I believe it's actually a military term called blading. And it's kind of, you know, like a position, the way to position your body that could serve as a threat to someone who's concerned about you possibly being armed and dangerous. So he said he was blading, but, you know, he didn't think he was fleeing because he was maintaining eye contact with him, which made him think that he was tracking him. So the officer feared for his life. And, you know, as soon as the officer is in fear for his life in Florida, that is justification. If other factors are at play, such as the fact that Rennell Bing was driving a stolen car and crashed head-on with this officer. And another thing that jumped out to us in reading some of the evidence was that I guess the evidence shows that he was actually accelerating. So, you know, this doesn't look like, based off the evidence, that he was trying to avoid this officer. It looks like he could possibly have been aiming for this officer. And then you're talking about assault with a deadly weapon. So there are a lot of legal nuances into how you justify a police shooting, but assaulting an officer with a deadly weapon is certainly one of those things that you can point to say, well, look, this officer was justified.
Okay. And then, as you pointed out, eyewitness accounts are notoriously unreliable.
Yep.
That said, what were some of the eyewitness accounts that differed from the police officer's narrative of events?
Yeah, and you know, it's also worth noting that while eyewitness accounts are unreliable, you know, these witnesses from, you know, and I didn't actually get a chance to go through and listen to these audio recordings of prosecutors interviewing these witnesses, but one of my colleagues did, and when the witnesses were, you know, politely challenged on their recollections, they stuck by their memories. So it's not to say that they were wrong. It's just that it can be tricky to maintain that kind of a memory for a long period of time, which is part of the controversy before Melissa Nelson took office, was that there was concern about the thoroughness of the investigation. In other words, if you're not going out there and canvassing for witnesses and talking to them as soon as you can, you risk having less and less accurate witness recollections of the event. So I know that the civil attorney, when I first got here, actually was one of the first stories I wrote, was the civil attorney filing a lawsuit over the shooting, and he was very upset about what he called, you know, a shoddy investigation. And when Melissa Nelson took office, she did change the protocols of how these things are investigated here. So instead of one prosecutor, there's now a team of them. I've read a lot of police shooting files in Jacksonville, and I've never seen one quite as large.
Certainly Nelson far more transparent than her predecessor Angela Corey in releasing as much information as possible. But again, my question to you was, how did the eyewitness accounts differ from the police officer's account? Because that seems to have been what has sparked the ongoing protests and also a civil lawsuit.
Right. So eyewitnesses reported seeing Vernell Bing getting out of his vehicle, limping away from the officer. So that's one difference, right? So, you know, the officer says that he was kind of circling his vehicle, but not fleeing and tracking him with his eyes. Witnesses didn't see that. You know, witnesses saw him limping away from the officers as if he was continuing to flee. And one witness said that, you know, when Officer Landerville actually opened fire, that he was close enough that he could have reached out and touched Vernell Bing. So that witness was basically saying he chose to do this. He didn't have to. You know, he could have taken him to the ground in another way. He didn't have to use deadly force. And, you know, we obviously have that account, and then we have the officer's account. So those are the two kind of
different. And we're speaking now with reporter Ben Konark of the TU. He's been covering this story as it has unfolded over a period of 16 months. No charges will be filed in the shooting death of Vernell Bing Jr. What are your thoughts? Lots of calls. It's 549-2937. Mark is on the west side. Hi, Mark. Thanks for holding. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I've been paying attention to this case, too. And from what I've read in the Times Union and other sources, some of these eyewitnesses to the case could not have been operating in good faith. I mean, they were. You know, one of them, I believe, said that he saw the police officer walk up to him after he was on the ground and shoot him in the back. And I think the forensics reports all said all the shots came from, or the one shot that killed him came from the front. I was wondering, do you have any experience with our state's attorney now? That do they follow up and try to prosecute these people for, you know, if their eyewitness testimony so contradicts the investigation, the facts of the case, does the state's attorney's office go back and try to prosecute them for lying to a police investigation? Because we see this happen time and time again.
Thanks, Mark. Ben?
I've never heard of a prosecutor going after a witness in this kind of situation. You know, I think in an obstruction of justice charge, you know, if there's evidence that a witness is purposefully lying, but if you're just grabbing someone off the street who just witnessed, you know, a traumatic event and they may not recollect exactly right, or they may, you know, we still don't know. So, I don't see that in this case.
Okay. Jennifer on the north side. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi. Yes. I just wanted Ben kind of gloss on a perspective that I think is pretty popular when he discussed eyewitness accounts and how they're unreliable. Also, any testimony from the police officer is also, he's an eyewitness as well. If you factor in adrenaline and you factor in, you know, circumstances, that can also alter your perspective as well. So my question is, what eyewitness accounts corroborate a police officer's comments to the fact of the events, and is that backed up? So like when you go and find witnesses and canvass them, you usually want a great amount of witnesses to corroborate so you know that it's as factual as it can be. What corroborates what an officer says besides the fact that he's an officer? Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, and then it's also worth noting before I get into that is that, you know, body cameras are coming to Jacksonville and the pilot program is already here. And this would definitely be an instance in which this would have been captured on the officer's body cameras. So there wouldn't be any questions about, you know, whether the witnesses were correct or whether the officer was correct as far as, you know, what Vernell Bing's final movements actually were. But, you know, you're absolutely right that police officers are subject to the same mental issues, or I don't know if issues is the right word, but the same mental challenges that, you know, everyone faces in recollecting events. And that's part of the reason why we see more and more departments turning to body cameras to get an objective view of what happened. And obviously, body cameras don't always capture everything. But, you know, I do think that it's also worth noting that, you know, given the way that the law is written here in Florida, police officers, after a shooting, do get to, you know, look at the scene, or the union representative gets a walkthrough. And the officer has quite some time, I think 2 to 4 days usually, before they have to give a statement about what they saw. So officers are afforded more ability and more kind of luxury to get their story a little bit straighter before they have to give a statement. Witnesses are usually just pulled off the street. So that is a difference also to keep in mind.
Yeah, I mean, certainly officers have a leg up in these controversial cases in terms of just more leeway, more latitude. It's unusual for a police officer to be charged, even more unusual for them to be convicted. And the few cases in recent years, Ben, that I'm aware of where a conviction did result had largely to do, as you said, with either body camera video or citizen video that went viral and showed the officer acting improperly. And
right.
So as you said, body cameras are coming to the JSO. Sheriff Mike Williams has also talked about more extensive use of de-escalation techniques in these types of highly charged environments. That's something that law enforcement is really adopting, it seems, more broadly, particularly in the wake of all of these controversial incidents that have swept the country.
Yeah. You know, I think de-escalation is a great thing, and I think that, you know, mental health training and any way that you can get, you know, we have a really hardworking police force here that has a lot to respond to, and some of these police shootings that we've seen in the last year especially have resulted from mental health incidents that may not have turned out the way they did if we had a trained mental health professional responding to these, even if they were responding with the police. But, you know, that requires funding, and that's something that we haven't seen a lot of. But as far as de-escalation goes, you know, in this particular shooting with Ronell Bing, you know, this situation was escalated kind of from the start. It was a high-speed police chase with speeds in excess of 100 miles per hour. You have a situation in which an officer very well could have been killed by the impact of this crash. It's actually kind of miraculous that he was able to get out of his car and collect himself kind of as quickly as he did. So I don't know if de-escalation really applies to this particular shooting. I think that this was a situation that was, you know, very highly charged, kind of a split-second decision.
Kirk in Arlington. Hi, Kirk. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. Listen, the whole system is set up to oppress black and brown people, and it would never change. The police officer know all they have to say is, "I fear for my life." That's a license to kill. Understand that the same people who were hanging black people back in the 50s and 60s, their children are now the police officers. That's not going to change. And when you have a union that backs everything a police officer does, you will never get justice in this country. Never. Not until this whole country is destroyed. Never. You have to have them saying that they feel for their life. They don't have, like the reporter just said, they don't have to give an account of what happened right then. They get time to think about it, put the plot together, get their witnesses together, and everybody backs them. In this country, you have less than 1% of police officers that are found guilty, even with the video camera. That's all I have to say.
Kirk, thanks. Ben, it's that sentiment and that anger that has driven protests nationwide, including here in Jacksonville.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I hear that a lot, and I definitely I can sympathize with that and relate to that. I think it's even a stronger sentiment here in Northeast Florida, where, you know, I've read books about the history of Northeast and Central Florida, and it's not that long ago. You know, it's and I think that's something that you hear a lot from local activists, that this was 60 years ago, and some of these people who are out there protesting, their parents saw the KKK colluding with law enforcement around this area. So there, you know, there are a lot of not too distant historical events that have led up to these sentiments between African Americans and the police. So I totally understand that sentiment. I do think, you know, here in Jacksonville, we've seen in the last couple of years a pretty concerted effort from, State Attorney Melissa Nelson and Sheriff Mike Williams as well to try and at least start to address these concerns. So I think that is something to feel positive about, but clearly there is a lot of work to do.
With regard to that, Robert emails the show, State Attorney Nelson just set a precedent with regard to transparency. That she is choosing not to pursue charges speaks volumes to the merits of the case. It's good to see facts and evidence determine the results of a decision, not emotionally and politically charged agendas of local special interest groups. So lots of points of view on this here. Nick in Mandarin. Hi, Nick. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First, I'd just like to say, it's horrible when we have any kind of loss of life, whether it's intentional or accidental. With my comment, some people listening to the show today will, just based on my race, I'm not a brown or black person, so I have no standing in this conversation because I don't know what it's like to be oppressed, quote-unquote oppressed. Unfortunately, though, when these incidents happen, we send our police officers to training. We entrust them with our city, and we give them specialized training and diversity courses and how to defend themselves and protect us. And when this, something like this happens, the first thing we do is attack the police officer. This whole conversation this morning, which I thank you for starting, there's been zero discussion or minimal discussion to this person from Mr. Vernell Baines Jr.'s criminal background. I mean, first he made an ad in the paper for a fake prostitution sex for money, and then stole the guy's car, had it for a week. There's crack cocaine found in the car. The guy's got a criminal history that's pages long, which I think leads to your comment.
That's certainly all true. That said, I would ask you as a follow-up, did he deserve to die because he committed crimes?
No, absolutely not. He didn't deserve to die. But again, that goes to my first point. We entrust the police officers with their training, and we spend thousands and potentially millions of dollars on our police force and coming with the body cams to support their decisions. So we either support them or we don't. Yes, there are always bad apples. There's bad apples in every entity, just like in the community, this individual, Vernell Bain Jr. But there's little to no discussion about it. And when you do talk about it, you hear terms like dog whistle, you're a racist, you can't say that because just because he's brown or he lives in Springfield, so anyone who lives in Springfield is a criminal. And that's what we're someone who wants to be part of the discussion is pushed back on because I don't know what it's like to be oppressed. So that's my comment.
Nick. Yeah. Thanks, Nick. That's Nick in Mandarin. Ben Konark.
Just one point of clarification. I don't believe that, at least based off the report that I read, I don't believe that, the car was stolen during that incident with the Backpage ad, but I don't believe they know, police know exactly how it got into Vernell Bing's hands. And I said, obviously, he was driving a stolen car, and obviously there was a criminal history there. But you see this a lot with police shootings, especially is that, the person who was shot ends up getting kind of put on trial after their death, which I always feel a little weird about. I think that we should focus on the circumstances that, obviously led up to the shooting, which includes a high-speed chase and a very violent crash, which I think is all fair play. What he might have been doing a month ago or 2 months ago before the shooting, I think is kind of less relevant.
And, as you've pointed out, Ben, in so many of these cases, there are complexities. There's a lot of information to process. But as we listen to the calls come in, it's really striking to see people falling into the usual divisions terms of how they perceive these types of flashpoint moments between a young African-American man and a police officer. Jacksonville has the same issue that every other city in the country, it seems, just about, is grappling with when we talk about this.
Yeah, policing in America is getting a lot of attention these days based off this idea of racial bias in policing. And I think we see, from the media, we see project after project basically seeking out data that backs us up, and it's not very hard to find. You can find racial disparities as high up as police shootings and as low down as jaywalking. There are biases in policing, and it's worth talking about. It's worth having conversation about it because that's kind of the only way I view it as the only way to start to heal these divisions.
Let's take some more calls on this. Carl on the west side. Hi, Carl. Thanks for holding. Good morning. Go ahead. Go ahead, Carl. All right, Carl, we must have lost you. Christine in Springfield. Christine, of course, this incident happened in Springfield. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I just wanted to say that I was part of another case, the Jax 5, where I got arrested for peacefully protesting. And one of the first things that JSO did was release a statement full of a bunch of lies. It took a mass movement of the community who knew who we were to actually come out and speak against that before they could get it switched to the truth. So I just think about families like Rennell Bing. And I see his mother on Knife and Liberty almost every day out there crying for her son. And people who don't have the ability, who aren't activists in the community, who don't have the ability to pull a community to help them change the narrative. So when I hear things like, JSO says this or the police statement says that, I'm super skeptical of it, and I think the whole community should be. I hear arguments for body cameras. That's fine, but what I think we really need is community control of the police. I think we need to have people elected from each district who are civilians with no relationship to JSO and not appointed by the mayor so that we can start hearing the stories of the people not manipulated by JSO's bias. So that's really all I have to say about that.
All right, Christine, thanks. A tweet from a listener. State Attorney Nelson's decision is disappointing because it is a slap in the face to any trust-building effort that could have come about with the Jax 5 decision. Pardon me. And they're referring to the group of five protesters that were arrested in Hemming Park during an anti-war protest. State Attorney Nelson basically let them off, didn't pursue anything there. So.
Right. Well, she let them off because they hadn't committed any crimes.
Right.
But, I mean, I think that they, I think it's a mistake to say, because she made the decision in this case that the race is what she did in another case. You know, I think you have to, especially in the legal world, look at things on a case-by-case basis. And in this particular shooting, I think she kind of did the same thing she did with the Jax 5, which is that she looked at the evidence and came to the conclusion based off Florida law as to what she should do. And that's kind of her job. But as far as citizen control of the police, I know Ms. Kittle knows this, that there is a law in Florida called the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, and I believe it's in a dozen states, and that would preclude any meaningful citizens review board. So that's not a possibility here in Jacksonville unless that law gets changed at the state level, which would seem to be unlikely given the control of the House right now.
Emily on the west side. Hello, Emily.
Good morning. I just wanted to add a couple of things. I do want to emphasize that I agree with the laws. The laws need to be changed. And people, I like to say, he said, this happened, that happened. Melissa Nelson is a much better candidate in her position. The only thing I'm saddened about is the relationship that the state attorney's office in every judicial circuit has with the sheriff's department. There is a lot of bias and a lot of fine line. But Melissa Nelson, on the utmost, has to abide by the rules and regulations of Florida, and we need to change some of those. And the other thing, someone pointed out that training, that our officers get a lot of training. I think that people need to do 119 requests and realize the training that they are getting. They're getting training to be, they get awards for DUI, the most DUIs. They get awards in training in avenues that they are wasting money. I don't know who polices that, but I can tell you that if you pull a file and you see the training that an officer has had, you just want to chuckle because it's not something that we think we should be paying with our taxpayers' money.
Okay. Thank you for that. One more call, Tyrone on the west side. Go ahead, Tyrone.
Yes, my question is, if I witness a police shooting a black man, by me being a black man, and I get off my job, chance myself that they'll be a witness, but it's never justified, it's never credible. The black witness is never credible. And I'd like to know, why would I witness something and go testify because of the waste of time? And I feel like the police officers in Jacksonville, they'll get your big good and your bad. But everybody, first thing they put up on the television is the criminal record. And that shouldn't be justified of killing anyone. And that's all I have to say about that. And thank you very much for your show.
All right. Thanks for that. Lots of folks calling in today. Ben Konark, as you have reported and as this station has reported, there will be no charges against the officer. Bring us up to date quickly on the civil lawsuit, and then we'll let you go.
Sure. Yeah. The lawyer for the civil lawsuit told me yesterday that he's waiting on a motion or a ruling for the second motion to dismiss the lawsuit, which is basically, they're trying to get it tossed before it gets too far along. You know, it hasn't gone into discovery yet, and I know that that lawyer received a personal call from Melissa Nelson yesterday, and he told me that he is quite pleased with the amount of records he has now. He feels like he can start to put a case together, a civil lawsuit, so that we will continue to follow as it develops.
All right. Thanks for getting on the phone with us. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Reporter Ben Konark of the Florida Times Union with us. Much more still ahead later. A new leader carries on the tradition and legacy of Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Northeast Florida. But up next, they're helping not only refugees, but victims of extreme weather. How World Relief is bringing relief to the world and this area, too. That's in a moment.
He's a rap music pioneer whose style is invading pop culture, Gucci Mane. His life story runs through the rough streets of Alabama, the heights of the music industry, prison, rehab, and the drug-dealing hotspots of Atlanta. They call those hotspots traps, just like his rap style, trap music. Gucci Mane, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
From PBS and Emmy Award-winning directors Ken Burns and Lynn Novick comes a landmark documentary event, The Vietnam War.
What was it all about? Was it worth it?
It was extremely traumatic, like the ground was suddenly cut from under you.
See the series Vanity Fair calls a monumental achievement, The Vietnam War.
Tonight at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Hi, this is Ray from Car Talk. You know, for the last 30 years, you've had to put up with this. And we know it's been a struggle. Well, it's time for Car Talk to make room on this station for something new and hopefully a little more professional. You can still listen to us online, but here on the station, we hope you enjoy the next generation of great programs. And thanks.
Join us for the final episode of Car Talk, September 30th on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the organization World Relief is perhaps best known for its work in resettling refugees, but they are also involved in disaster relief. So, as you can imagine, they're pretty busy right now. The local office of World Relief has been working hard as a hub for relief donations, as well as funding local churches and communities working to help those affected by Hurricane Irma. Now, there is an important deadline to apply for some relief funds that are available to you out there. We're going to tell you about that in a minute. World Relief is also working with local partners on the ground in Haiti and the Caribbean. Here in studio with more, we welcome Travis Trice of World Relief Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, World Relief Senior Vice President of U.S. Ministries, Emily Gray, on the line from Washington. She'll be here at the end of the month. Emily, good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Melissa. It's great to be with you.
Now, you're going to be the keynote speaker at a benefit happening here on September 30th. We'll tell folks about that in a minute. But first, educate us on the work World Relief is doing right now in terms of helping people impacted by disasters like Hurricane Irma.
World Relief has been doing disaster work around the world for many, many years, whether it was the massive earthquake in Haiti, Hurricane Mitch in Central America, the tsunami in Japan. And in all of these efforts, We have worked either through our local offices or through our partnerships with the local churches. In our mission to empower the local church to serve the most vulnerable, they're our implementing partners on the ground. And so what we're doing through our Jacksonville office, where Travis works, as well as through churches in Houston, our office in Haiti, churches in the U.S. Virgin Islands and other places, is finding those partners that are really able to quickly assess the needs of their communities and to come alongside them with the funding that people give through our website in order to enable us to do the vetting and find really the best uses of those funds.
So, Travis, how is that working here on the ground in Jacksonville, and how can people access some of these relief dollars, relief funds that are available? There's a deadline coming up in a few days for people that might qualify. They need to apply now.
Yeah. So once again, this is through local churches, and there's been some wonderful stories. One comes to mind of Southside Baptist Church. Shout out to Pastor Gary Weber. Who have been housing displaced people. They've been a partner with the Red Cross, and that's San Marco. That's an area that was hit very hard. Lots of displaced people, and even people who aren't from the First Coast, but they're stranded here from down south.
Right.
And they've been housed there through the gym. They've opened up their showers to them. And so for, that type of situation, what World Relief wants to come in and do is help what's already going on. And so if you are a church out there, we've already got quite a few we're working with. We don't have unlimited funds, but we do have, funding for churches who are, doing relief efforts related to Hurricane Irma. And you can learn more about that on our website at worldrelief.org. And the deadline is September 25th. There's got to be some paperwork involved to make sure that we're, affecting the right cause here.
And so churches that qualify could access some funding that they could use to just help people that are displaced, whatever that means, whatever that entails.
Absolutely. And it goes even beyond funding. Our office has been really lucky to have some great church partners from even out of state. We had a church from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, that down a huge truck full of just stuff that the church put together. That went to Deer Meadows Baptist Church here in Jacksonville. And then they contacted us. And through those partnerships, we've been able to get supplies out to as far south as the Pompano Beach area, Dade County, Fort Lauderdale. And we've seen these supplies just go everywhere they need to go. So what World Relief has done is we've got a list of needs and a list of provisions. And one good problem to have, but a lot of churches are right now, maybe even listening, in this situation. They have too many donations. What do we do with all this stuff?
Get out of here.
Yeah. And so what we're trying to do is help them get that stuff to the people that really need them.
You'll take it off their hands and get it out there.
Absolutely. We're even storing it. In fact, we've got a tractor trailer coming in this week, another one from Chicago. I mean, it's coming in, and we're trying to get it out to the right place.
So you're an important portal.
Correct.
And so, with all of that said, Emily Gray, you are World Relief Senior VP of U.S. Ministries. You are coming here to Jacksonville on September 30th to speak at an important event. It's a way for people to support World Relief. What's going to be happening?
This is an event, the title of which is Love in Action, and I think everything that Travis just described, whether it's tractor trailers from Chicago or Tennessee, that's just really love in action. And we're really hoping to get more of the community there in Jacksonville to understand what we've been about for decades. The office there celebrated its 25th anniversary last year, so 26 years now that we have been really trying to show that love and action to newly arriving refugees and immigrants coming from some of the most war-torn parts of the world. So that really requires a lot of concrete service, but it also requires a lot of friends and a lot of relationships. So we really hope that folks will come out to that event. I'm going to be sharing a little bit, as well as some really fantastic music by some choirs of local churches, as well as dance from other ethnic groups. So it'll be a multicultural evening, hopefully educational, but really find out how is it that you roll up your sleeves and show love in action.
Mm-hmm.
And this is coming up September 30th, which is not this Saturday, but next Saturday. Mm-hmm. Travis, right. Trice, how can people get their tickets?
Well, you're going to go to our local website, worldreliefjacksonville.org, and there should be a big logo there called Love in Action, and you can purchase either an individual ticket or a lot of organizations, businesses are purchasing a table. And I'm telling you, it is going to be – we've put a lot of work into this benefit dinner. There's going to – the food, by the way, is prepared by some of our refugees who have great culinary skills. There's going to be some wonderful ethnic meals there. And as Emily said, there's going to be some Burmese dance, Congolese singing. And we're going to share some incredible stories by some of our volunteers here on the First Coast who have – been impacted by their volunteer work with the refugees. And we're going to have them there at the banquet too that night. So
it's worldreliefjacksonville.org. Click on the Love in Action button and come on out on September 30th and support these amazing efforts, World Relief, not just in the business of helping refugees, although they do that, of course. They're really playing a vital role in relief from Hurricane Irma and our own displaced people right here on the First Coast. Emily Gray, Senior Vice President of U.S. Ministries with World Relief, on the line, and Travis Trice in studio heading up the local office. Thanks for all you do, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Great to be with you. Thanks a lot.
And we'll be right back.
We're getting into fall and the holidays, and you know what that means.
Gives you this warm, nostalgic, and kind of loving feeling that a lot of companies want you to feel that when you think of their products, of course.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How a certain flavor that shall not be named came to dominate the autumn. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele, hoping you'll join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Fitzgerald Theater. Our guests include Jim James, Amy Mann, and the hilarious comedy of Hurry Kondabolu. Plus, the Royal Academy of Radio Actors and Ms. Sarah Watkins will be in the house. We'll have our musician's birthday salute, the Powdermilk Instant Song Request, and I'll have a brand new song for you, all this and more this weekend.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
For the next jazz night in America, Eddie Palmieri and Harlem River Drive.
And my problem with Harlem River Drive is that I wanted a crossover. And you know who were my biggest fans? The anti-government movement, the Weathermen.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next jazz night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, he was a giant in the local philanthropy world. The late Warren Grimes passed away earlier this month after a long battle with cancer. He was 68. But Grimes left an amazing legacy under his leadership. He took Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Northeast Florida from the brink of bankruptcy to a multi-million dollar organization that's become one of America's top affiliates. Now, you also heard him regularly right here on our airwaves here at 89.9, helping to raise money for WJCT. He was a longtime friend of this station. And now, a newly appointed CEO is carrying on Warren Grimes' legacy. We're pleased to welcome Sarah Alford, new CEO of Big Brothers of Big Sisters of Northeast Florida, here to the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with her, board member Jason Spencer. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
And Sarah, first off, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's been brought to my attention that only 30% of C-suite positions in the nonprofit sector are filled by an internal candidate. Usually nonprofits think, We need someone fresh. We need new blood. We need an objective outsider to come in and shake things up.
Yes.
That didn't happen with you. So you rose through the ranks to succeed the late Mr. Grimes.
I did.
And what a legacy you have to build on.
Absolutely. You know, Warren was a visionary in the city, and he had a remarkable business sense about him. And he really brought that to the nonprofit community in ways that he elevated our organization within the community itself. And I hope, you know, I had the benefit of being with him for 10 years and really more intensively the last 2 years. And so I'm hoping to continue that knowledge forward as we move into the next phase of Big Brothers Big Sisters.
Sure. And under Grimes, the number of students served annually in this community went from 350 to nearly 1,200. Nearly 100% maintained their school performance, got promoted to the next grade level. Big Brothers Big Sisters of Northeast Florida, one of the top affiliates in the nation. And Jason Spencer, of course, what you guys do is you match at-risk kids with an adult mentor, either a big brother or a big sister. It's such an important, it's such an easy concept, but it's one that really has such a big impact on kids.
Absolutely. When I think through what I have in my life and from a mentor standpoint and the mission of Big Brothers Big Sisters, having that one-to-one mentor relationship where kids can learn valuable life skills and they can have someone that they can trust and help them grow and develop, it's very important in our community. And one thing that Warren did and he understood is that allowing children of the Jacksonville area to have that access was very important, and it was near and dear to his heart. Mm-hmm. And then he's publicly said the best job he ever had was being CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters, and I think it was very much fulfilling that mission.
Yes, and in fact, he started a fun event, Margarita Jayville. That is coming back.
It is.
This is coming up soon.
It was, yeah. So actually, we were going to have it September 29th.
But you've decided to postpone.
We have. Due to Irma and recognizing the city and community's need to recover, we've pushed it back to November 18th.
November's going to be a very busy month on the social calendar, isn't it? Every year, I'm sorry to cut you off, but every organization in town has postpone their events to November. So it's get true. Ready. November's coming. It's You're going to be out there every night doing something, people.
Oh, it's so true. And we're particularly excited about this event for this year. Warren had started Margarita Jayville his first year in 2014 with the agency. And we decided to really bring it back in honor of him. It's going to be a celebration of not only Big Brothers, Big Sisters, but Warren's time with us. It's an island, you know, Jimmy Buffett style party, for lack of better terms, and it's going to do some great work for our community and for our program and sustainability of our efforts here in Jacksonville.
And as new CEO, what are some of your goals as you take over this mantle from him to further grow this agency?
Well, I think I'm uniquely coupling my expertise and program with everything I learned from Warren. And I'm so excited to celebrate what the city is doing. You know, the Chamber's efforts, we're in the top five for Metro Cities for job growth. We're part of the National League of Cities. We're doing some really important work in the realm of juvenile justice reform and intervention here in Jacksonville. And so I really think we're going to take a lot of cues from the city, and we're going to take our multitude of program opportunities, some as mature as 100 years old and some of our more recent innovations, and start to find ways that we can be the best partner for the city of Jacksonville and our surrounding networks. And that's particularly true with things like Beyond School Walls, where we're making equitable pathways towards workforce development through our DJJ efforts and informing mentors for our opportunity youth. And then, of course, in how we're influencing our community relations with our public service partners through our Bigs in Blue and Bigs in Badges program.
Last but not least, Jason Spencer, if anyone out there listening wants to become a big brother or a big sister, how can they do that?
Well, they can contact us via our telephone. They can give us a call at 904-727-9797, or they can visit our website, and they can find additional information about how to become a big brother or big sister here in the Northeast Florida area.
It's not a big commitment.
No, it's not. And depending
it's like
on,
1 hour a week, isn't
it's
depending, it?
It's 1 hour a week, depending on which one of our programs that you allot yourself to. We have our community-based program, which Sarah alluded to, has been for 100 years, and that's more of a one-day-a-month type commitment. And then we also have our community and schools programs, which is more of a 1 hour a week. And that's for someone that's a little busier and may have a more professional life that needs a little more structure.
And of course, you want women to do this. But in particular, it's always been my understanding, you really need men.
Absolutely.
To mentor young boys in this community. Isn't that just so important?
It's absolutely important. You know, and it's unfortunate that we have a wait list of young men that are looking for that right mentor to step up and be an influence in their life. And if there's any men out there that are listening to this, please, we love to have you on board. Love to have you working with the children in our community that desperately want to have someone in their life that can influence
any
them.
Any man can do it. You don't
any
have,
man can do
you
it.
You don't have to. I'm sure a lot of men think, oh, I wouldn't qualify or I wouldn't be any good at it. That's not true.
That's not true. We have a very in-depth process that we'll sit down with you. We understand what your passions are, and we'll match you with the child that aligns with what you want and that what that child wants, and make sure it's a great match. And that's one of the things that makes us successful. I mean, our average match length is over a year because we work with individuals and make sure that we align those children with the right mentor, and it's a fantastic relationship. So yeah. Any man at any phase of your life is welcome to be a mentor for us.
Give them a call or go to their website, bbbsnefl.org. Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Northeast Florida. A nice tribute to Warren Grimes, their late CEO, on the website. And congrats to new CEO Sarah Alford and board member Jason Spencer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Get our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app, and you can catch the rebroadcast every night at 8 p.m. Next on 1A, how does America First work on the global stage? I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.